I'm Michael Krasny. I want to welcome you to another episode of Gray Matter with Michael Krasny, a weekly podcast of deep dive interviews. And you can become a member of this podcast simply by going to graymatter.show, and that's gray with an E. We cover a wide range of timely and intellectually engaging topics distinguished by what we believe is high-level content and technical excellence. In this episode of Gray Matter with Michael Krasny, I welcome UC Berkeley Professor Emeritus of Sociology and award-winning best-selling author of such books as The Second Shift, Strangers in Their Own Land, The Managed Heart, Timebine, and Stolen Pride. Harley Hochschild is a graduate of Swarthmore with an MA and PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. She also is a recipient of many honorary degrees from Harvard Law and universities across Europe and in Canada, and is the author of a children's book called Colleen, the Question Girl. I want to welcome my friend Harley Hochschild to Gray Matter with Michael Krasny. Good to be with you.
Delighted to be here, Michael.
Well, I thought we'd begin by talking a little bit about a book you did back in 1989, Second Shift, which had an extraordinary impact and still does have impact. I don't know how you measure that as the years whirl along, but by that I mean, you know, it really focused on how women were doing work in this so-called feminist age or post-feminist age that we're living in, and also doing the housework still and doing all of the, well, childcare and drudgery type of work to a great degree. How do you think that's changed now is really what I wanted to hear from you. I mean, especially in light of the fact that we're kind of in a new alpha male era, it seems. Trump is trickling down, cascading down with what many people feel is toxic masculinity, and the old roles are maybe back in alignment. Things have changed, haven't they?
Well, they've changed, I think, Michael, in a lot of ways. One, I wrote Second Shift in 1989, when not all women were working. It was a new thing. Now it's most women, and it's an old thing. And I think most men have risen to the occasion, you know. And the backstory is that in this period of the 90s, the male wage declined, and women were recruited really to the workforce to make up for the gap. And men saw that, hey, we need her wage. And so I don't know if we're backsliding because we're still in that economic situation.
The economics haven't changed, but the traditional roles seem to be moving a little backward.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, what we're really talking about is a change in the culture of pride. And the old culture of pride is the guy would take pride in providing for his family and really leave it at that. He wouldn't take pride in helping his wife and sharing with her. He wouldn't take pride in co-raising the kids. And that's the shift. There was a shift, I think, to the new man, to a new culture of pride, where you're really glad to help your wife, and you're really glad to be in there in your kids' raising. That's the have we slipped back to the old culture of pride, where he comes home and puts his feet up on the sofa and says, "Get me a cup of coffee, dear." No, I don't see it. I don't see evidence of it. There may be talk in a kind of a Trumpian way. I don't think we've got the big slip back.
Well, is it also pretty much along the lines that you've outlined when we look at, say, the white poverty communities that you found yourself doing work in, like in Kentucky and Louisiana? Or right. Is there also this similar kind of shift that you just pretty much characterized?
Yes. The last book, let me say a word about that, Stolen Pride, was based on work in Kentucky Five. That's Eastern Kentucky, coal country. And it is the whitest and second poorest congressional district in the whole country. Coal's out, opiate crisis in, and that situation, I found there a kind of a microcosm of a national story for the 42% of all Americans who are white and don't have BA degrees, of kind of a downward move for those. So let me say a word about that, and then how men would treat women, or, you know, back to the second shift. For that 42%, what we've seen over the last three decades, decline in wages, decline in property, and with that, a kind of a social logic sets in of kind of more people living alone. So you have more single mothers that don't have a guy to share it with. You know, so that's a different story. She's doing it all. Maybe her mom is helping, but he's not.
She's a provider, basically.
Yes, she's a single provider. And he's out of the story, and he's not doing well. He's not being, you know, king of the roost. Either he's repartnered or he's living alone. And in this group, actually, there's a high proportion who are kind of victims of what they call deaths of despair, more alcoholism, more drug addiction, and more suicide for white, blue-collar men. So the question is, are you, you know, taking care of the kids out there on the baseball diamond with your son, or doing something at the table, cutting out figures with your daughter, or were you out on the baseball diamond with your daughter? Are you present at all? Becomes a kind of a basic issue in a region of economic decline. So that's the story. You men may not be doing their part of the second shift, but they're not in great shape.
No, they're being also eclipsed in terms of women's productivity and women's rising to higher levels in terms of businesses and so forth. There's been, you know, a different kind of proportionality there, hasn't there?
Well,
more educated women, though, for example.
Yeah, that's right. Although I don't see, well, that's an interesting question. Are women in greater leadership positions in Kentucky Five? I wouldn't say I see that. But in general, they're less susceptible to diseases of despair because they're taking care of the kids. They're in jobs that are generally low paid. You know, let me read you a passage, if I might, from the book that really, I think, tells this story. Here's a guy that tells you the story of men, I think, in this region. And they're not sitting pretty, treating their women like slaves. Over lunch, this grandson of a coal miner, told me this. When I asked him, there's a situation of loss. How does it turn to shame? He says, shame comes gradually. Let me give you an example of guys around here, where I live. First thing, a guy gets his layoff slip, and he blames the inspector, then the supervisor. Then he shakes his fist at the Obama administration for putting in the Clean Air Act. Then, when his unemployment runs low and his wife asks for money for groceries for the kids, he faces a hard choice. If you need money and don't have a degree, you've got to leave. But his family's here, and he doesn't want to leave. That's when he starts to feel bad about himself. He looks around at the jobs on offer at $9 or $10.50 an hour, and he turns his nose up at what he thinks of as a girly service job because he can't support his family on that kind of money. But then his partner says, we need to feed the kids. So he takes the crap job, and she says, there's still not enough money for food, gas, and fixing the roof. It's then that his shame begins to get stronger, because now he feels the problem is on him. And if he leaves on Route 23 looking for work and comes back empty-handed, that's shame waiting for him at home. Then if he gets into drugs, take it from me. He was a 12-year heroin addict. He's ashamed. That can lead to divorce and separation from his kids, and now he's on the dole. He always felt superior to others he saw on the dole, and now he's on it too, so he's ashamed about that, mad that he's made to feel ashamed. Then he may read some op-ed in the Appalachian News Express calling people like him a deadbeat for not supporting his family, paying town taxes. He's not a contributor. On top of all that, he sees on the internet people outside the region firing insults at him as ignorant, racist, sexist, homophobic. Now he's mad at the shamers. And by this point, he's forgotten about shame. He's just plain pissing mad. So that's the guy who would be sharing the second shift. And that's his situation.
Yeah.
And he's voting for Donald Trump.
Certainly. And that was certainly a lot of what motivated you initially, wanting to find out, you know, why people were behind the Newt Gingrich movement and all of that, but then ultimately behind Trump. And I don't know, I must tell you, I have some ambivalent feelings about this. My own background is pretty blue collar, and so I understand, and I have a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion, especially when you talk about the shame. But I'm also aware that there are people who are execrable, you know, who welcome the kind of, let's say, extremism that Trump may represent in their minds, going after the liberals and hogtying them, to use a kind of appropriate metaphor, or debasing them. That gives them a good deal of pleasure, doesn't it?
Well, I'm telling the story from the other point of view. I get you where you are. You're saying there are people who really are racist and really are sexist and really are homophobic. That's what I hear you saying. And yes, of course, you're right. But I think not just sociologists and journalists and you and me need to step back. We need to step back and get where they're coming from, how they got into that situation, rather than condemning them, cutting them off, the Democrats saying, oh, we don't need the whole American working class. Two-thirds of people don't have college degrees. We need this reach out, and the reach out can't begin with a quick judgment about attitudes. The reach out has to begin with getting to know people and figuring out their situation.
No, I'm in agreement with you, especially and admirable about the way that you were able to, you know, as someone who's been very mindful of the importance of interviewing people and how valuable it can be in drawing them out. I think you've done superior work in actually talking to people and getting them to trust you, and especially with a Berkeley pedigree and all of that, you know, it's really remarkable in
some
ways.
They're amazing people, you know, and the privilege is mine. And I didn't find the kind of hard-nosed, quick-to-ridicule people that the stereotype has. I've met some people that hold, okay, attitudes I firmly don't agree with, but they're held not in some saucy way. And I think it's not a big, giant step for the Democratic Party and the liberal left half of America to first see what we've been denying over the last three decades, that there are haves and have-nots of globalization. We're in the region of haves. We have college educations. We're in that region and of that class. But there's been other regions. Rural America, you know, has taken a big hit. Great people, big hit. And we need to reach out. And they would welcome it. They do welcome it. People here come back to Berkeley, oh my goodness, how did you do that? How did you get them to trust you? Well, no, it's easy. Anybody can do it. All you have to do is be interested. And I think we should do it. There needs to be a lot more bridge work. And there are people at the in this region, for example. Okay, these people in Kentucky 5 used to be FDR Democrats. They used to be Bill Clinton Democrats. Many used to be Obama Democrats, okay? Region 5, Congressional District 5. And, okay, what happened? Big things happened, and they have taken a big economic hit. Coal jobs left. That is their major source of pride, gone. Nothing else came in except opiates. And they've taken a big hit. And I think loss is more psychologically powerful than sheer deprivation. If you once had something and then it's gone,
that was the appeal of Make America Great Again.
Yes, precisely.
But there's also, you know, you mentioned Obama, and I can't help thinking a little north of the regions that you've worked in, but I think of Pennsylvania when he said these people just cling to their guns and their Bibles, and that sort of thing makes them angry.
Yes,
that's
it does.
The indignation, isn't it? You know, you're thinking that we're racist and you're thinking that we're sexist, but also you're thinking that all we care about are our Bibles and our guns when, frankly, we do care about our Bibles and our guns.
Well, that's true. They've been socked twice with shame. Now, shame isn't a word that we hear used in politics or really, it's just kind of a old-fashioned word that we're not
thinking. Too many politicians are shameless. That's the problem.
Shameless and shaming. I mean, everything is shaming, counter-shaming. But I think what's happened that we really need to understand, and the reason I've written my last two books is to make us bilingual so that we're both listening to the rational discourse that goes on, but also to the irrational discourse. There is a logic to Trump's emotional appeal to people who've taken an economic hit and are suffering loss, mainly the white working class, but others as well. He's speaking to loss, and I think what we have is a whole shamed blue-collar sector who are very proud people. I mean, they want to be working and self-sufficient, and they blame themselves if they're not making it. Very old-timey culture of pride, so that it's up to you to make things work, and then the industry goes away. You can't. You have to leave, but you don't know anybody in Cincinnati. You don't have a BA degree, so you stay where you are, but there are no opportunities where you are. So that's the kind of situation they find themselves in, locked in. And so they're shaming themselves. And then, of course, they turn on their Facebook and get on social media, and they find that the liberals are shaming them, so double shaming. Then I think what happened is that Donald Trump saw an opportunity. He prospected it, he produced it, and then he lit it aflame as if it were shame were itself a lump of coal. And he did it through, I think, a four-moment anti-shaming ritual. If you read it emotionally, you can see that in everything he does almost weekly, there are these four moments. Moment one, Donald Trump says something transgressive. He'll say, Asians are immigrants are eating your pet cats and dogs. Moment two, the punditry shames Donald Trump and says, that's shameful for you to say that. That's not true. You don't repeat a lie. Okay. Moment three, Donald Trump becomes the victim of the shamers. Look how they're picking on me. Look how they criticize me. Don't you, my followers, know about that? Doesn't it feel terrible to be shamed all the
time? And don't you identify with me, even though I'm a man who was born with a golden spoon in my mouth?
Yeah. So that's right. That's right. They disregard that. I think he's a shamed guy, actually. I mean, personally, I don't think he had a great relationship with
a
harsh judging father.
Yeah, a tough father.
Sent off at age six.
I knew I was going to be talking to you today, and I couldn't help thinking about an interview I did recently with a mutual friend of ours, I imagine, Orville Schell, who was talking about Putin and Xi and how they were shamed and they felt, you know, identified as victims and so forth. This goes along on every level of class and every level of stratum of society.
It does. And I'll just come back to that after number three, you know, he's shamed, and four is the roar back. That is the 1, 2, 3, 4 anti-shaming ritual that he fills in the blank with different episodes for each time. But I think the Democratic half of America is listening to moment one and two. Donald Trump says something transgressive and the punditry shames him. But I think the Republican half of America tunes in to moment three and four. He becomes the victim. He takes on the shame of his followers. I'm taking the hit for you. And then moment four, the great roar back. So he's turned shame into blame, and people have an appetite for that because shame for all of us is a terribly painful thing. It's like a kidney stone. It's hard, and we none of it like it. So he's getting rid of it, and they're elated at that. So I think that is the emotional message we need to tune into, be bilingual so we hear it when it's happening. Especially three and four.
You can understand it, but you can still be drawn to it like the siren song or something.
Exactly.
If you're in the situation, especially of indigence and, you know, suffering from feeling your own personal shame deeply.
That's right. So we need to first intercept it, not say, oh, you blamey people, you're racist, da-da. No, that's not where to tune into this. If we're going to be the reach out party and cultural movement that we are, the good people that we are, and it's not hard to do that reach out. You know, we used to have a very powerful labor union that was the middleman between the working class and the Democratic Party. But unions have gone out. I think it's less than 9% of private sector workers, maybe down to 6, are unionized. So that structure that made that connection is gone. And we need to either get unions back off their on their feet or get some other kind of structure going. I think it could be done, but we haven't figured it out.
Maybe some naysayers would say you have still too much faith in the Democratic Party as a possible major party or too much faith in unions as a major force in American life because, to some extent, the MAGA world has now eclipsed things. I'm struck by something that was told recently by a producer I used to work with who talked to a lot of young men, working men, and asked them, why do they vote for Trump, which was really what you were trying to find out. And their answer was almost universally, now this may have changed in recent times because of all the firings and the buzzsaw and everything, but they said, look, he's backed by Elon Musk, who's the smartest and richest man in the world. That gives me enough confidence in Donald Trump that I'm going to vote for him. And these are many cases where people who were aligned with the Democratic Party for many years.
Right. But they're people
that... Or families were, excuse me.
Yeah. People voted for Donald Trump for a lot of reasons, but one of them was that the Democrats didn't seem to offer anything for them.
They
would have been interested. I'm not saying they would have voted, but in this district, 80% voted for Trump of registered voters, but 20% didn't. vote for Trump of registered voters. And then some third didn't vote at all. So if you put all the people in Kentucky 5 together, you've got half that did not vote for Trump. So why don't we look at them and the non-voters, the democracy's dropouts, and what's their story? Who would they have gone to? The people that I came to know in Kentucky 5, and I've just talked to the major people in the book again as to their response to recent events, and they're confused, and a lot of them are in doubt. You have people estimated of the registered voters, something like a third to 40% who voted for Trump and are gung-ho. Oh, he means well and he's doing well, that group. But then you have people, well, I came along for the ride. I don't know if he means well. I don't know if he's doing well. And they're now wondering, hey, are these Medicaid cuts going to affect us? This is a region where over there are on Medicaid, and they're working, by the way. So they're the working poor. And that would be a huge hit. Social Security, Musk has said, is a Ponzi scheme. Well, people I came to know really depended on that. Food stamps. So a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, does he mean well? Or even if he means well, is he such a mess up? Whose hands are we in? And I think it's time for the Democrats. You're right. Maybe I'm putting too much faith in them. But I'm looking at people like Tim Walz, who's now out and giving talks. I'm looking at Bernie Sanders and AOC, who are going.
Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat.
Well, that's true, but it's kind of on the other side. And many people, actually, who were turned off at the choice they had in November, are saying, well, at Bernie Sanders, you know, he's saying it like it is. I don't know what the labels mean, you know, Democratic Socialist. Maybe I'm a Democratic Socialist. I heard one guy say. So there's rumbling, there's uncertainty, and we, I think, just have to lift off the labels that have been put on this shamed sector and see ourselves in them. Hey, AI is going to do to the middle class exactly what the loss of coal has done to this working class. And they're just like you and me, vulnerable, and they can be in the situation. What happened to them is they gave up on both parties. Like you, they would, you know, just why talk party? Nothing's happened to us or for us in the last 30 years.
But you've pointed out they've been voting against their own interests.
Well, yeah, but a magic man comes along and they think, you know, charismatic leader, what the hell? Why don't I give him a try? Who else is coming for us? It's kind of that despair place that a lot of people have been in.
I have another view of the Trump phenomenon. I think a lot of it with people who are down and out and identify with him just like him as a performer. Because he is, you know, you mentioned his charisma. I mean, it's real, but he's also someone who's performing, who's chaotic in terms of what he does from day to day. And people, you know, it's like turning a shock jock on the radio. You listen to him because there's something there that's unexpected. Did he really say that? Did he really do that? You know, and there's a kind of a thrill in it.
Yes, I'm sure that's true too. But underneath the thrill is a despair. Who's going to help me? I want to buy a house, you know, or a trailer. And, you know, can I get the money out? You know, eggs are going up, gas is going up. Can I afford to drive to a place of work where I'm getting $12.50 an hour? There are real things. It isn't just, oh, hey, politics is fun. People are...
No, I don't mean to apply to it's the exigencies of day to day. You're right. It's the mundane. But I'm also wondering, and I'm interested in your thoughts about this, about don't know if you remember the name Harry Golden. This really goes back. I mean, we're both old-timers, but he was somebody who used to say that a lot of, and he was talking about the South, which is where you've done so much of your research, that he wrote out of North Carolina mainly, I believe. He was saying that the white poor were able to feel superior to the black poor because they were white. Sure. And they had that feeling of, I mean, you can call it white supremacy, racism, whatever you want to call it, but that was a real element in their sense of dignity or pride or whatever could give them a sense of lack of shame with dignity and pride. They were better than especially the urban blacks in their own minds.
Well, how different is that from many of the put-downs that people on the left have made of blue-collar people and blue-collar Republicans? Why are we in the put-down business, you know? The racist or the non-racist? There's a lot of... Actually, you know, one interesting finding that on reach across, bridge building, who left or the right is better at it, turns out that it's progressive Democrats who are more likely to cut off communication if someone says something they disagree with than are conservative Republicans. So, you know, and whites are more likely to cut it off than blacks are. So that's on us, okay? And the other finding, it's very poignant, is that if you want to kind of lower the temperature on a particular issue disagreement, it's conservatives who are much more likely to soften their views on something if they sit across from a liberal, if they get to know them, if they have a meal together, if they, they're more likely to change their views about the left if they really get to talk to them. Now, okay, we're talking rural, semi-rural people who are used to kind of that kind of connection, but that's the very thing that the left is bad at. You know, they're a little more rigid and icy.
So, and snobbery, too.
Yeah, so come on, let's fix it. If it's right. Broken, fix it. We're fix-it people.
Well, how do you fix elitism, though? How do you get people to
it's not
sort
hard.
Of repair their feeling of being elite or being superior?
It's not hard. Elitism itself comes from, I think, some kind of insecurity often. So, no, it's not impossible. It's actually very easy, and we need
well,
to
when you
do
reach
it.
Across these and you make these connections and bridges with people, talk about that a little bit. I mean, you do it through your humanity, your kindness, obviously, and your compassion, but also, I mean, there's a wonderful story, I'd love to hear you tell it, about talking to someone, and she said, you got me there. It was a Pentecostal Christian who you were talking to, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
You remember the story I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. You know, it was very, very poignant to me. Yeah, this is...
It's a poignant story, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this is from Strangers in Our Own Land. That came out in 2016. And it was based on research around Lake Charles, Louisiana, another very strong, originally Tea Party and then Trump.
Bayou country,
yeah. Beautiful country. And I met an extraordinary Pentecostal singer. Her husband was the preacher minister of a large Pentecostal megachurch. And I met her at a meeting of Eastern Louisiana Republican women. So I went there, had some gumbo, and sat next to a woman who said, I love Rush Limbaugh, who's the well-known, highly conservative humorist and
No longer with us.
No longer with us. Radio host. Really the biggest, kind of dominated daytime radio, highly conservative and beloved of Donald Trump. And so she said, I love Rush Limbaugh. He's, and I said to her, so first it took me a minute half minute. Okay, my alarm system's off. I'm just interested in what brought her there. So I said, you know, could we sit down for sweet teas? Can I invite you? I'd love to understand why you love Rush Limbaugh. So a few days later, we're sitting down for sweet teas, and I ask her why she loves Rush Limbaugh. Oh, he's my dear heart. And she said, because he hates feminazis. So I thought, I hope you don't know that I've written the second shift. I'm probably who you're talking about. And so I said, well, what is a feminazi? Oh, it's a harsh, self-centered woman, and she won't let the man open the car door, and she won't fix his meal for him, and so on. And then she goes on to environmental wackos. Well, okay, who would that be? And, well, what is an environmental wacko? Well, and then she, as she's describing it, you know, these are simply other people. And she said to me, you told me that you don't agree with what we believe around here. Is it hard for you to hear what I'm saying? And I was taken aback. She was watching me. And then I said, truthfully, no, it's not hard at all. I feel grateful that we're having this conversation. I'm learning a lot. And, but no, I have my alarm system off. And my presence here, the purpose of it is not to convince you. It's to learn what you believe and why. And she said back, oh, I know what you're doing. I do that too. I do that with my kids. If they're fussing at me, I stand back and take my alarm system off, and or with parishioners who are complaining. So we had that in common. I left back a kind of a bigger person. Did I agree with her anymore? Of course, I did not agree with her. But did I feel a human connection? Yes, that I had not before. Yes. And I recommend the experience.
Well, that's a wonderful way to, you know, overcome the kind of gaps that exist between people on the left and people on the right, if they can just make that human connection as mothers or fathers, or as, you know, people who feel and experience things in similar ways, that they can actually communicate on a different level. It can humanize, and it can be a really wonderful kind of thing. But I think part of the problem that underlies all this is the difference in education too, don't you? I mean, these are people who feel shame because they're not educated in many instances, and they meet people who are educated, and they feel right away, that person feels superior to me. Even if they don't feel superior, that's what they project.
I think people who, and people described me being in that situation. My grades weren't that good. I didn't take school seriously. My parents didn't have money. You know, my dad's a truck driver. You know, just as smart as you and me, but on the other side of what turns out to be a kind of a cultural paywall, you know, and we need to do something about that. It should be, you know, extensions to the curriculum in universities.
But to do what, Arlie? I mean, especially I ask that question in light of the fact that many of these people feel there's a preferential treatment for those who have darker skin, or they can get into schools that my kids can't because they have melanin, that kind of attitude. And again, it increases their sense of estrangement and anger, doesn't it?
Well, that's another issue. Yes, yes, it does. Strangers in their own land, I came up with what I call a deep story that I think is the feeling counterpart to right-wing politics. And the deep story speaks to it. It's a story. It's a story. So it's not precepts. It's just how things feel. It feels like you're standing in line, and at the front of the line, far, far away, is the American dream. And the line hasn't moved. And one guy said, I haven't had a raise in, you know, a decade. And you feel like you don't begrudge people, anybody else. You're just waiting to move ahead in the line. And then in the right wing, deep story, there are line cutters. And these line cutters are, who are they? Women, blacks, immigrants, refugees, even environmentally protected animals. Why? The people put animals ahead of us. You know, these are all cutting in line, so you can't move forward. So a kind of economic stasis is blamed on these outgroups. That's the right-wing deep story. I went back with that story to people, and a guy said, oh, I live your metaphor. Oh, yeah, you read my mind. They don't feel like they are personally prejudiced. Talk to a guy in Eastern Kentucky, and he said, I watch CNN, and they call us racist. It makes me furious. Why don't they know we had the first integrated cemetery right here in Pike County? You know, so don't write people off quickly, I guess. That's the first thing.
It's good wisdom.
Yeah.
You also have said on a couple of occasions, social norms actually guide feelings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How is that so? I mean, as opposed to politics guiding feelings, for example.
Well, we have what I call feeling rules. Rules about what it's okay to feel or not okay to feel. Feeling rules. And we live in a world that's not just full of behavioral rules, but rules that govern how it's okay to feel. And what I think Donald Trump has done is to alter those rules. That is, culture has kind of got many expressions. And that's the basic, most important one. And he has punctured the rules of civility that have prevailed, really, for, I'm going to say, centuries. Now, I know there's been a lot of kind of hot spots, and I've lived, and you have, through some of them in the 60s. But now there is a new meanness that people are invited to feel okay about.
And even cruelty.
Yes, yes, cruelty. Exactly, exactly. So it's time, I guess, what I really now today worry about is not so much the right, it's the left. What is this paralysis that is governed by the left? I mean, all those that did not vote for Trump. I should use another word, the non-Trump part of America.
Do you also fear the totalitarianism of the left? Because that's what we keep hearing, not only from the right, but from people in the center, that the left has become too ideologically rigid, and especially, how shall I put this, woke, I suppose, is the word that's so often used and maybe overused, but that people respond to that in a very negative way.
Well, we have to sort things out here. Woke isn't the same thing as totalitarian, I think. What is on my mind is not the totalitarianism of the left, but of the right. It is Donald Trump now who is saying, I'm going to expel, you know, some immigrants who are not proven to be criminal to Venezuela. I'm just going to send them off. Or, you know, if you speak up against the victims in Gaza, you can be just picked up and sent to a prison in Louisiana. This is totalitarian. This is the real deal. And I had breakfast the other day with a young Russian scholar who's here temporarily, and he left Russia after writing something that opposed the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And he said, I've read Stolen Pride. What happened in Eastern Kentucky is exactly the story that happened to all of Russia. That's what happened to free fall in the 90s. It was shamed. A totalitarian charismatic leader cashed in on that shame. I'll make Russia proud again. So it isn't about this or that person's attitude toward DEI. We're talking about something bigger. And we need to address the problem, I think, by talking about it as it's going on around the whole globe. And what's happened is, I think, globalization has destabilized status systems everywhere. And the losers in that, especially the elite of the left behind, are the evangelists of a new order that should be, it's okay if the leader is totalitarian. We're in the grip of that. So how do we get out of it? First, we understand it, and that's by being bilingual and understanding the emotional messages written on the wall that we're ignoring. And then reach out. First, speak up, support those who speak up, and reach out. Don't crouch in a corner.
On those wise admonitions and suggestions, thank all of you who joined us for this episode of Gray Matter with Michael Krasny, which you can listen to on Apple, Spotify, and also on our website at graymatter.show. If you haven't become a member of the podcast, I invite you to join by going to the website at graymatter.show, and you can find previous episodes there. That's Gray with an E. Also invite you to mail any reactions or suggestions you might have to me directly at mkrasny@graymatter.show. My thanks to the Gray Matter with Michael Krasny team, Alex, Shannon, Chad, Kevin, Jeff, Colleen, and a special thanks to this week's guest, Arlie Hochschild. So good to be with you.
Thanks so much, Michael.
I'm Michael Krasny.
Bandwidth for Gray Matter is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.